And welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 672. After missing the last couple of weeks, we are back. Holidays over. Going to have some fun here. We're talking some fantasy baseball with a friend of the show, talking about some of his recent work, some players that are kind of scuffling these days, and maybe how we approach this for the rest of the fantasy season as we just passed Memorial Day, about a third of the way through the season. Decisions need to start getting made on certain people, so we'll just discuss them very loosely here and try to make some of our own decisions. But my guest, he's been on the show a few times. You can find him over at Underdog Fantasy, Baseball America, his Substack, BrendanTuma.substack.com, and on Twitter at Too Much Tuma. Brendan Tuma, how are we doing, my friend?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great.
Like you said, it's kind of that point of the season where you do kind of start got to making some decisions on guys and figuring out which way the wind's blowing for you this year. So it's, as we were talking off air, it's a busy time right now, but it's also, I think, you know, a really fun time if you're if you are locked into any of your fantasy teams or your real life baseball teams or everything going on in the great sport of baseball.
Yep, it is a great time for baseball. It's fun, like Memorial Day, you get a bunch of the day games. You got just the weather's most places, I'll say. This one, sorry, my camera went out for a second. But yeah, we're rolling into the heart of baseball season now, the summer months. And we're going to talk about some of your recent work as you've been working at, we're going to kind of talk about one of your Baseball America articles, which you started this year. Congratulations. I think I haven't talked to you since you took that on. So congratulations there. And then we'll talk about one of your Substack articles as well before we hit on some players. But you recently wrote an article about the Yankees pitching rotation, which when Gerrit Cole went down earlier, everyone was like, oh no, it's the end of the world. Like the Yankees are done. Not so fast, my friend, as the great Lee Corso would once say. It's been pretty good there for the Yankees. So before we talk about a few specific players, when you wrote this article, what did you kind of like find out or anything that interested you when you saw this Yankees rotation that's been pretty dominating?
Yeah, so I think, at least for me, the way that kind of articles are just like thoughts on players or, you know, even just like little individual tweets and stats that I might send out, what it stems from is just kind of like, it's mainly Fangraphs, but also a lot of baseball reference and just kind of like perusing around of different leaderboards and setting different thresholds and different, you know, time qualifiers. And one thing I noticed is that the Yankees, I just went down a loophole of, oh, their starting rotation this year is doing really well. I wonder how well that does historically for them. And I kept having to go back and back. And it turns out that the Yankees rotation to this point of the season has their lowest ERA since 1917, which is just, you know, such a long time, especially for all the great pitching teams that they've had over the years. So that just kind of made me interested into how are they doing this, because it didn't necessarily feel that dominant, but then you kind of look at their staff as a whole and they've stayed healthy. That's I think the biggest thing. The five guys that they started the season with, even without Cole, have taken the ball every time they've been asked, and the results have been, you know, very good.
Yeah, they've been very, very good. And I think there was some expectations for some guys to be good. Some just kind of hold the fort down type modes, and they've really overproduced. Well, that's rude of me to say, but I think they've exceeded many expectations, at least some of these arms. And so I want to talk about a couple of them here for sure. And I want to start with the man that's going to pitch later this day as we record on Wednesday in Anaheim, Luis Eel. He has been amazing so far this season. His recent run has been next level good, but just as a whole on the season, he's been pretty much lights out. When you look at the grand scheme of things, he has a 2.11 ERA, a 3.55 xFIP. The Sierra's pretty close in line there, but like, you know, the strikeout to walk rate's very, very solid at 18.6%. But it's more like I hinted at, the month of May has just been a whole different Luis Eel. I think I talk about him every time he pitches now on the First Pitch podcast because it's crazy. Like his strikeout to walks jumped up to 22.1% in that time. When you dug in on Luis Eel, I won't take all the stats because you actually have a lot of good stats on this. What did you find out about him? Because I know there was a lot of high excitement towards the end of draft season for Eel, but there was also kind of like the, well, when you look at the grand scheme of things, the dude, how long are we going here? Last year, he threw 4 innings. The year before, he threw 25 innings. It was a big, like, what are the Yankees going to do? And right now, he's running wild. So what did you see when you look at Luis Eel?
Yeah, there've been a few kind of late around pitchers with, you know, quote unquote good stuff that we just didn't know what to expect workload wise, command wise, like Heal, Tanner Houck, Jared Jones, that have kind of just like exploded and been, you know, really important for fantasy teams. And I think in Heal's case, you know, again, it's always like, okay, it's great stuff, but is he a reliever? How's the control? How's the command? How many pitches does he have? And I think for me, or like late in draft season, like you said, when he started getting a little bit buzzy, it just became clear that the stuff was a level or two above everyone else's. I think every now and then we will just categorize someone as, oh, it's good stuff, but it's spotty control. Like Christian Javier might have good stuff, but the control might be so bad. But for Luis Heal, the, you know, quote unquote stuff was so good that it just made it kind of impossible to ignore. And I think the stat that best exemplifies that is his batting average allowed, which is just among the league leaders. And the first thing that you might think is, okay, that might just be BABIP luck induced, and it very well might be, like he might be getting favorable results right now. But when you look at his expected batting average, which again isn't everything, it shouldn't be used necessarily to be predictive of what's to come next, but he's just where he ranks is among like nasty relief pitchers. Like there's no other starting pitchers around him. He's so hard to hit that he can give up some walks and have it be okay. Now there will ultimately be a tipping point there. And if the overall control does worsen, he could be in trouble. But for what he's done, you know, if he stays this level of, you know, strikeouts and walks and hits allowed, then I'm definitely buying for the long haul.
Yeah, and the question, I guess, becomes what's the long haul for Luis Heal? That's the million-dollar question, because even early on, it's like, okay, just get us to June so Gerrit Cole can come back at some point. Like that was just kind of the discussion point with Heal, and then you move him to the bullpen and hope like stretch him out that way type deal. It's going to be hard to take him out of the rotation right now. It's one of those where they go six-man and kind of preserve everybody. That'll be an interesting discussion point. Those will obviously come later when Cole gets back, but I'm with you. It's an adage I've talked about on other shows. And like I had Draft Cheat on towards the end of draft season on this show. And he really like, and then even Paul Sport came on and talked about it. It's one of the things that I think I need to become better at is you mentioned Jones, Houck, Eel, all these kind of innings concerned guys that are dominating. Maybe it can be like a, hey, let's turn into just trust the innings you get now, figure the rest out later. Don't worry about the end of the season. Get to the end of the season. And Eel's like a perfect example of that.
Definitely. It becomes really easy to fixate on, is this guy going to be there for the whole season for me? Where it's like, even if Heal honestly were to go down in the next few weeks, like if he was a waiver pickup for you or a late round draft pick, like it's already been a win. And Crochet fits into that bucket as well. It's like, how long can this go for? And I would just keep focusing on the skills. And like you said, worry about that later.
Yep, ride them out as long as you can and just be thankful that you got these outstanding innings. Let's talk Carlos Rodon, because this is a guy that maybe it wasn't so much like an innings situation with him, but more of a health situation with Carlos Rodon, because he's even like towards the end of draft season, there was questions about his health. Like, what are we doing here? So he didn't make you feel warm and fuzzy, but he's been pretty darn good this year. Every outing, 3 runs or less except one. So 10 of 11 starts, 3 runs or less. The last 4 starts have been really, really good. Strikeouts have slowly seems like they're coming back up, not consistent every game, but as a whole are there. We're still like, he's not dominating, I'd say, like we saw a few years back, but much more serviceable than last season, obviously, with Carlos Rodon. So when you dug into Rodon for this piece, like what did you find out of him? Are we optimistic on good things to come, or is it kind of like a mixed bag of stuff with Rodon?
I was skeptical of Rodon entering the year because I thought there was 2 ways that he could bust. I thought it could be, you know, obviously health related, which could impact, you know, the quality of his arsenal. If he wasn't at full health, he wouldn't be throwing as hard. I also thought that what we saw last year when he was healthy, he just completely lost the command that he had in that 1 year with the Giants and then the end of his White Sox tenure. And the reason why he's worked out so far this year is because the stuff has come back in a big way. He's actually throwing his slider harder so far this season. And he has also added a cutter. So it's just giving, you know, pitchers a little bit of a different look. To me, this kind of says like he's just, this is kind of his evolution as a pitcher. You know, this happens to, you know, everyone as they get into their 30s. You kind of got to maybe tweak your arsenal a bit or add a pitch, a show me pitch to help get it over type thing. So I think the, you know, the glass half full take here is that he's staying healthy and that he's kind of learning to pitch and not just throw. So that's a big plus for me. At the same time, when you and I put this in the article, but if you go to his Savant page and they show kind of where the locations where certain pitches are being thrown, if you look at his 2022, he was just really dotting the fastball and slider. And when you look at it for this season, it drifts a lot back more towards the middle of the plate. So I think that that's the concern, and his ERA is overperforming his Sierra. So I think that that's a concern as well. And I think you just like package that all together. As long as he stays healthy, I think he was probably viewed as very volatile this year. Like he's either going to be healthy and be incredible or not pitch at all. And I kind of think he's morphing more into a little bit of like a boring SP2-3 who's on a good team who should get a lot of wins, and there's still always going to be that single game strikeout upside.
He almost feels like a bit of Kyle Hendricks before he went downhill. But like when Kyle Hendricks was like just that steady Eddie, like Rodon might have a little more K upside, but in reality, he doesn't have a ton right now. He's like, it's not crazy, but he's like you said, he's just getting you through the starts. He's not getting blown up. It looks like he should be getting blown up, but he's not. It's just one of those things where it's one of those. I think if I rostered Rodon, I could probably trade Rodon if you're in trade league. That just you strike why the iron's hot on this one. Where like at least Luis Eel and some of these guys, you're a little more optimistic. Like screw it, I just want this domination for a while. So it is interesting, like you said, he's becoming more of a pitcher than a thrower, which I think we're gonna see a lot more guys do with these recent slew of injuries. Even though Tyler Glasnow did say like, hey, if you throw fast, you get paid. So that's why these guys are doing it. Like Glasnow flat out said, I'll have the surgery every so many years if I'm getting paid. And I'm like, that's wild, but probably not the wrong mindset, sadly, with the way the world works. But yeah, it's interesting with Rodon. I didn't specifically pick out any other of the three because you mentioned they've stayed strong, which they have. You have Stroman, you have Nestor Cortez, you have Clark Schmidt. Like I've looked at Stroman, just he's another one of the boring ones, pitcher, not a thrower. Cortez has amazing home road splits. It's scary what he can do. Like I looked at that for DFS. And then you have Clark Schmidt, who I was all in on last year. I wanted this Clark Schmidt that struck guys out, not the one from last year. This is an amazing Clark Schmidt. So I'll let you pick out of those three. I'll give you one more guy from the Yankees that you'd like to talk about that maybe stood out to you in this piece.
Yeah, I'll just give Clark Schmidt a shout out as one of the things I did in the piece that I made this graphic for it and like color coded, highlighted it and everything, but just kind of looking at some of the skills of each of these Yankees pitchers and comparing them to each other. So like their Sierra, their Stuff Plus, their ball rate, their ground ball rate, and just kind of making a nice visual to look at. And Schmidt's probably the most balanced of all these guys on the Yankees. He has the lowest Sierra and he has the highest strikeout minus walk rate. And he does get good grounders. He does get whiffs. He doesn't have, you know, as big of control issues as Luis Gil does. I've been really impressed with him. I kind of had wrote him off entering the year, same thing to you. You know, I thought it was buzzy and interesting last year. And then I'm like, this guy is never going to get lefties out. And that was another thing with Houck. Like I salvaged getting Houck in one league as a waiver pickup at one point. But like those two guys, I had just written off because I thought the platoon splits were too severe. And I still got to even do, you know, deeper dive to make sure that's something that, you know, I or we don't miss heading into next year as well. But I thought the platoon split would be too hard to overcome.
Yeah, I guess it's one of those we and I'm guilty too. That's why I say we. It's about maybe as a community, not just me and you. It's almost like we have to start realizing these are young kids and they're still developing. And it's like we always talk about what if they could throw one more pitch type scenario. Like that's the ticket. And we don't know what they're doing in the offseason because we have no clue what they do. So like that could be the kind of angles. Like, do you just speculate or do you go to the boring veteran at that point in the draft? That's kind of a philosophy thing, I guess, a draft day philosophy on those players, because they don't all work out this way, but we have seen more of them of late, like you said, where it's not as, you know, it's cut and dry as a platoon split or whatever in those scenarios.
I think
all right,
No, sorry, if I could add on to that. I think something I try to really balance in baseball is in football, which I enjoy playing fantasy football too, but it can happen so quick. There can be, you know, this rookie or second year player that just athletically explodes. And that's just the guy you had to have. And in baseball, I think we talk about fantasy a lot that way. Who's the rookie that you got to reach on in your draft because he's going to be your league winner and all that sort of stuff. But something I'm trying to lean into more and more the past couple of years is just understanding that the development curve in baseball is just really different. It does, you know, often take multiple years. And I think heading into this offseason, I really want to start looking at players more from like a multi-year trend perspective and not being so reactionary to the past calendar season on their stat sheet.
Well, and even with like the Red Sox, like they get Bailey in there and a whole new philosophy to the team that I know I didn't take into consideration, but it's pretty cut and dry with majority of that rotation. Like there's a whole
Like if you had just bet on the Red Sox rotation and taken one of the guys in every draft, you know, for the most part, you'd be doing pretty well with that.
Exactly. So it's little things like that that maybe I need to focus on a little more as well. All right. You had a couple Substack articles of late that I wanted to touch on. One's about some pitchers that could be seeing, you know, return to goodness is the way I'll say it. Maybe it's not as, maybe the numbers aren't as sketchy as they look. So let's talk about Pablo Lopez, because this is a very volatile name out on the streets these days. I know this article came out, I think, before his last start, which did not go as well, but the story stays the same, I think, when it comes to Pablo Lopez. Got the 5.25 ERA, but when you're looking at peripheral stats, it's a 3.05 xFIP, which is outstanding. And we look at the Sierra, 2.96 Sierra still after the blowups. The last few starts have been rough, but there's a lot of indicators pointing to goodness ahead. He still had 11 Ks over 9 2/3, so that was there. When you looked at Pablo Lopez, what made you go, okay, hey, this is rough, I get it, but we should, like, better days are to come for Pablo? I know my co-host Ryan Bloomfield is Pablo's one of his biggest fans, so he's been getting a lot of questions on this right now. So what did you find when you looked at it?
It's funny, the way you always have it in your head, right, is that you either write the article, you send out the tweet, or you talk about him on a podcast, and then it's like from that point on, the flip's going to happen. And so yeah, I did write this before. I think maybe even like two of his more, two more struggling starts of his. And but before I came on today, I did look at the at his Fangraphs page again, and he actually has a better Sierra than he did last season. He's lowered the walk rate from last season. The underlying skills that, you know, I really like to look at and trust are all still really there. I think this is just, and it's really frustrating that, you know, you probably took Pablo as your ace in on your fantasy team this year, and that he just hasn't delivered the ERA, because even if he's what you expected from this point on, like, so much damage has already been done just from that ERA category. So that part about it is really unfortunate, but just every metric, that I look at, I still see the same, you know, guy who we basically thought, what he was going to be preseason. And it just really, sticks out to me as like a sort of like a classic traditional buy low, where we've gotten so good at analyzing, you know, the individual pitch shapes and why someone might be off or something might be wrong for pitchers. But sometimes I still find it helpful to look at, you know, BABIP or left on base rate for pitchers. And Pablo's left on base rate, it's just like one of the lowest in the league, and everything else checks out. So he's a pretty confident buy, I think.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's a rough couple starts. There's no denying that. And you were obviously starting them, so like you said, damage has been done. Like, there's no that. But it feels like one of those, like, hey, you suffered through that. Enjoy the benefits that are coming soon. Like, don't walk away. And because it's always one of the hardest things. And I'm not the only one that preaches this every year. But it's like one reason why I like Roto better than head-to-head is head-to-head, Pablo's crushing you right now. Like, it's it's horrible. He's probably losing you a couple of weeks. Potentially, like you said, he's your ace. You're expecting goodness. Roto, you just want that end of year number, and he could easily put on like a 6-start streak. You're like, wow, okay, we're back, baby. Like, we're back. And you forget all about these rough days, and you'd hate to miss those because you're angry. And that's one thing that I know myself, Ryan, and others are trying to tell people that send in questions what to do with Pablo. We're done with Pablo. Like, it sucks. That's the best we could say. It does suck, but you got to just, like, you drafted him for a reason. This isn't your, you know, 14th round fourth starting pitcher. This is a dude that you need to roll with in this scenario and see where it goes.
I think I heard it best after Bailey Ober's first start this year, when he gave up 8 earned runs. And I forget, you know, where I saw it or who I heard it from, but the way they phrased it was just like, this happened, and if he was in your Roto lineup, you now need to dig out of this hole. And the only way you're going to dig out of this hole is if you just still just trust it, because if you start getting cute and try to sit him for certain matchups, you could miss out on some of what's eventually going to help you there. So I agree with you. Yeah, it's tough, but you gotta just trust it in a situation like this.
It's a bummer, there's no doubt about it. Let's talk about Mackenzie Gore. This is a guy I liked a lot heading into the season, kind of like an optimistic approach. He's young, first kind of full season in the bigs, came over from the Padres, so on and so forth. And what we've seen this year is we've seen his strikeouts come up. We've seen his home runs go down. We've seen his walks go down. Like, everything you want to see from a young pitcher. And, you know, 3.04 ERA, 3.33 Sierra. A lot to like, it feels like, with Mackenzie Gore. What did you see when you dug into Mackenzie Gore?
He started to come around for a bit after the piece came out, you know, unlike Pablo. But again, even at the time of writing this, Mackenzie Gore had improved his strikeouts. He had lowered the walks. It was kind of a multi-year trend from that. It was really clean. If you look at the past three seasons for him, he just got a little bit better every year. We just talked about development, you know, kind of taking multiple years sometimes. Like, he was a top prospect. Like, he was part of the Juan Soto trade. So there's pedigree there, and it just, you know, it took him a little bit to reach this point. And then it was really what sold me is the fastball, because I don't know a ton about, you know, pitching on the real side of baseball. But like, one thing I hear people say is, you know, having a great fastball is really important. And you kind of look at some of the fastball, you know, stuff plus leaders and that sort of thing. And these are oftentimes, you know, some really high ceiling starters. And just looking at the stuff plus leaderboard for fastballs, like, Gore sat there, and you know, to me that explained why he was doing so well, and it was different from previous seasons. It he didn't have the same velocity or ride the past 2 years that he had now. And then on top of that, anyways, the reason he was a buy low is because his BABIP was really high. If you looked at his schedule, he had faced a murderer's row of lineups. And I think even tonight he gets the Braves again. So it's still, it's not slowing down for him at all, but his most recent start against the Mariners showed me what he can really do. And I think there's a little bit of, you know, prospect fatigue with him sort of thing. And so, you know, the Nationals aren't buzzy in terms of player development. We haven't heard a lot about him. So he just kind of seems undervalued to me, but I do really like him for the rest of the year.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think there's a lot to like with him. And I made the way too dumb / bold claim that if he improved the walks and let go of the home runs and took a big step, and then he hasn't taken the big step. He's taken a great step, but not the big step. Well, he could be that whole who's next year's Robbie Ray. I think that was a really, really bold, but I'm like, I see it in him. It's there. It's just, I think he's probably a couple more years away from that potentially. But we are seeing the growth, like you said, which is great to see, especially in these young arms. All right, another article you wrote involves some young hitters. And this is a fun one for me right now, because some of these guys are struggling and there's some frustrated fantasy managers out there. And so let's just kind of talk about, like, Andy Pajes, for one. Got called up. Everyone's excited. Hit really well out the gate. Like, nothing crazy. Slumping a lot lately. Still hitting .234, 22 runs scored, 5 homers, but it's been a grind. He's even starting to kind of lose occasional at-bats, which is not ideal. But if you just look over the last 2 weeks, Andy Paz is May 14th, hitting .137 with a 1 home run, 37% K rate. It's been a rough go for him. When you look at Pajes, what are you kind of seeing here that potentially stands out for the good or the bad with his situation?
It's really hard with rookie hitters this season. It's a kind of a little bit of a multi-year trend, possibly, of these guys are getting to the majors faster. And so the adjustment process that, you know, ordinarily a lot of these guys would have a full year at AAA, they're now just kind of learning in the majors because AAA is too bad for them. And Pajes isn't necessarily that guy, but he did have a shoulder injury that cost him some developmental time. And anyways, when he came up, he got off to a hot start. But what we're seeing is, you know, the major leagues are always going to adjust back. So, like, sometimes when I think of rookies breaking into the league, I almost would rather them struggle initially. Okay, they got that out of the way, and now they're the ones making the adjustment. Whereas in Pajes' case, it was, he did get off to such a good start, but the question became, how sustainable is that? And article came out like a couple weeks ago now, but one of the things I looked at was it became this running joke. He didn't draw a walk until his 18th game in the majors. And it was like, oh, Andy Pajes hasn't drawn a walk yet. How funny, he's doing so well. But like, in actuality, that was like a little bit of a concern. And his whole approach really is to just, he does a really good job of lifting the ball in the air, and he's got some good power. And so, I think that when he has a plan and knows what he's doing, he he's a really productive major league hitter, and I think he will eventually be, you know, a pretty good fantasy player as well. But I just think he's in this young stage where the major leagues are really hard, and we're seeing too many young hitters struggle across the board for me to kind of say, oh no, it's going to be Andy Pages who breaks the mold and is the one who's a star right away.
Yeah, no, that's a great call. I kind of got fooled into it. I didn't go heavy on him early. He kind of was sticking around in a couple leagues, and I went a little big at that point. Got a few weeks out of him, but it's starting to look like a not so great move. So I'm in that bag where I usually don't go heavy on young players. I could prove it to me type situation, and maybe I should have gone. So I stuck to my guns on that one, but time will tell. Talking about a player that has scuffled pretty much all season, and he was playing every day for the Milwaukee Brewers, and now he's kind of in and out of the lineup, still playing regularly, but is in and out, and that's Jackson Chourio. He's only hitting .215 this year with 5 homers and 7 steals. It's been a roller coaster, to say the least, for Chourio, but it's one of those, like, I was very skeptical of him entering the season just for the fact that dude hadn't played more than 6 games at AAA. Like, you talk about seasoning, like you were talking about with Pages and some other guys. Like, I know AAA can be jumped these days. People talk about the different levels and this, that, and the other, but I'd like to see a little bit, maybe just something. I don't know. But when you look at Jackson Chourio and the struggles this season, what are you seeing with him?
Yeah, he's probably one of the big examples to me of just how much our expectations have changed for rookies and how that's not in line with how quickly these guys are moving through the minors. Like, more than anyone, I think we can say now he can contribute to the Brewers at a major league level right now. He's flashing power. He's flashing speed. He, you know, shows a lot of upside defensively. You know, he's helping the Brewers right now, but I think for fantasy managers' expectations, this is the type of player who, you know, 5 to 10 years ago would have spent this entire season at AAA and just really worked on, you know, polishing a lot of his game at a level where the expectations weren't as high for him. So obviously, once the Brewers gave him that contract this offseason, that was a sign that he was going to, you know, have a really good shot at cracking the opening day roster. And I just think we're seeing him develop in real time. You know, Bobby Witt Jr. is someone I'm trying to keep in mind, as he is so good right now. He is everything that, you know, the wildest prospect fans thought he could be, you know, 3-4 years ago. And it took him a couple years to reach this point. So Chourio is also obviously an incredible prospect. I just think for this season, you know, we just really got to view it more as a developmental year for him and some of these other young bats, especially the ones with less minor league experience.
Yeah, and it kind of goes to what you're saying. It's kind of a trend like we've seen recently, and we've seen it like the second and third, maybe some fourth, the second and third year guys starting to burst out. Last year we saw it. We're kind of seeing it a little bit again this year. Like, pedigree's pedigree. I don't know if people hate that word. I get it. But it's like, just development takes different amount of time for different players, but we more often than not, I'll say, start to see it at some point in time. Now, that's the million dollar question. When is that some point, and how do you get there before it gets too costly? That's the tough part, but we are seeing it's usually the rookie year. We've seen at least 2 years now where things are struggling, and then they kind of start blossoming in the second and third years, and that can be fun. It's almost like the old, you know, fantasy football third year wide receiver. Like, it's kind of that whole thing right here, is we're kind of getting those players doing their thing. Last player from your content that I wanted to talk about is another young hitter, and that's Wyatt Langford, who returned from the IL on Tuesday. And this is the guy you talk about, not a lot of experience in the minors, huh? He started at Complex League last year because it was his first time in professional baseball, finished the year at AAA. So he went through the levels, one would say. Played great. There's no denying that. I was all out thinking he came up way too fast. The spring was amazing, though, so got everybody on board. He was hitting everything out of the ballpark. What are you thinking here with Wyatt Langford? Because I think it goes back to it's almost similar with all these. The skills are undeniable. It's just more of a get used to the show kid situation.
No, exactly. And he's the one that really makes me think, like, okay, this isn't just, you know, some 19-year-olds who got rushed to the majors and weren't ready. Like, Langford's whole thing was, you know, he might not have the biggest long-term upside, but he's going to be the safest as a rookie to produce right away. And obviously that hasn't been the case. So that's kind of, you know, hurt the entire thesis of drafting him as early as he was going. The Rangers lineup also hasn't been as good. And, you know, another part of the bet for him was that he was just going to rack up, you know, runs and RBIs, possibly in the middle of the order. It looked like at one point where he was sitting in spring training. And I don't have the exact stat in front of me, but when the bat tracking stuff first came out, I just did a quick search on like short swings that were fast. And there was one other qualifier, I forget, but he popped up in that. And I think the that kind of just validates some of the scouting report in him that, hey, yeah, this guy is a corner outfielder. You know, it's not an up the middle player. And that's why he wasn't, you know, in real life in consideration for number one overall prospect. But but the thing that all the scouts, you know, said is bat speed. And now we're going to start, you know, having the ability to see if scouts are correct when they throw that around on players. And for him, it looks like that really is the case. And so I do think, again, he'll figure it out long term. He was a top prospect for a reason. But the major league it's a lot different than, you know, the SEC. And then it's a lot different than, you know, minor league pitching, especially minor league pitching in the second half of the season when injuries have taken their toll. And it's just getting the quality is just getting worse and worse due to attrition.
Yep, I agree. I think there's a lot to like in the future at Langford, but we need to temper what we saw type situation last year. And like you said, the SEC is still the elite conference in college, but it's still not the professional ranks. So we got to remember those type of things. All right, let's talk about – I made a list of players, and I just kind of call it what to do with these players because I doubt you're dropping any of them, but it's a discussion to have. Like if you're in 10-team leagues, they might be drops. Like certain formats, they could be drops. But these guys are just frustrating, if anything. Like probably more bench targets than anything, but would you target them in a trade? A lot of scenarios could be taking place here. But I think we kind of overlook some of these guys because they're just like you think set it and forget it dudes, but they are kind of underperforming. So I'm going to start with Colton Cowser of the Baltimore Orioles, one of the only prospects that gets to play every day. And it was an amazing start. He earned every bit of that everyday playing time. There's no denying that. But you just look at the month of May in general. I'll just put that all together. He's hitting 176 with one home run and a 29% strikeout rate. It's been a rough month of May. He's still playing pretty much every day, which is good to see. But there's got to be a point where he's too much of a drain on your fantasy team to kind of hang around. So what's your thoughts on this Colton Cowser situation? Because he could literally be jumped into the guys we just talked about.
Yeah, so I was just pulling up to make sure I'm quoting the right stat here. But just, again, perusing some leaderboards, you know, one filter I like to set to is just rookies, just kind of comparing all the rookies to each other, who's, you know, advanced for a first-year player, who's not. And Colton Cowser's, his percentage of making contact outside the zone is just very alarmingly low. And it's too low to compensate for his, you know, mediocre making contact in the zone. So I think he has a sort of swing that when it's pitched in his wheelhouse, he can do damage with it. Because for a while, his, you know, his barrel rate's been really good. I don't know how he is yet at expanding the zone and, you know, maybe doing more than what he needs to do when again, he's not getting exactly what he wants. I think the biggest bummer has been, cause I was got pretty into him when he first started getting hot because he kind of is that, you know, second, third year, in this case, second year player, but someone who we saw had the struggles last year. So I'm kind of like, okay, he's learned his lesson. He did go back down to AAA last year and take back off. And so I thought, you know, this is the adjustment in real time. And, that hot streak was so hot that it made me think even if he comes back down to earth, the crash might not be that bad. You know, playing time is always something to think about with young hitters, especially on a team as crowded as the Orioles, but he's gotten the playing time the past handful of weeks. And they've had a lot of right-handed starters on the schedule. And so it's been definitely frustrating that he hasn't taken advantage of it fully.
Yep. No, I'm with you. I was getting all excited, you know, annoying people with the moo tweets and everything. Like it was fun looking like he was the dude and he still might be. The fact they're still playing him every day, I think, is a very positive sign because they've called up Kesson Hierstead and others, and they're just not getting the love that Cowser has got. So that's a plus. But eventually he's going to have to start putting up again or because they're contending. So he's going to have to get it done or get it out of the way. Johnny DeLuca a fun name when he was traded to the Rays in the Tyler Glasnow deal. People got excited. Like, I know I took him in a bunch of DCs and whatnot, like as a late round guy. And when he got healthy, he comes up, hits out the gate for about four or five games. Then it's out of nowhere. He kind of sits for like a week and then he comes back to playing, and it's just overall not good. Overall stat line sitting 219, 20% K rate, but over the last like week and a half, 30% K rate. It's been rough for Johnny DeLuca. What's your thoughts with him? Because it was one of the bigger pickups in Fab, and now it feels like he's best left for the waiver wire.
Yeah, I think the most frustrating part is it just hasn't been a rhyme or reason to the lineup usage. I think it's so satisfying when there's, you know, a player who doesn't have a full-time role but starts hitting well, and you see them be in the lineup more regularly, and that's how you get early on some of these guys. Like Joey Ortiz was a perfect example. He wasn't playing all the time. The Brewers were doing some nonsense with Dunn at third base, and but then Joey Ortiz started playing more. He kept showing good skills, and if you had pounced at the right time, you know, that's been a huge win. And I think with DeLuca, we all thought that's what we were doing, and then since then it's just been, you know, inconsistent. And I think they just view it as they have whatever it is, four players for three spots, five players for four spots, and they're going to mix and match them. I think the skills are, you know, pretty legit, especially for fantasy with the speed. And it looks like he can play, you know, some, you know, the Rays are always going to value that outfield defense, and that's helpful too. And so if he does start getting full playing time, I'll be interested. I kind of like what you said. He's a perfect bench bat for right now. Someone I'm, you know, ideally not starting every week unless he starts playing more, but someone with the upside that I do want to have a chance at capturing that.
Yeah, because I do love – he's got speed, he's got some pop. Like, there's a lot in the skill set that's nice. It's just he needs that production / playing time at the same time to make it all click. Jake Berger, this was a fun one in the offseason. Everyone's excited, you know, tons of power. Even hit even better when he went to Miami after the trade out of Chicago. Things were good, and then this season he gets an early oblique injury, and he has not been the same since he came back. He came back on May 6th, hitting 177 with one home run, 27% K rate, 22 WRC plus. You look at his 7% barrel, 44% hard rate. It's just been, I think he's still hurt. It's kind of how I'm looking at it. I could be totally wrong. When you look at what Jake Berger's got going on, and third base is a pretty depleted position overall. So if you have Jake, you're probably running with it, unfortunately. But what's your thoughts on Jake Berger?
Yeah, I think it's just been all the kind of like worst fears confirmed, whether it was, you know, it's the ballpark that's an issue, the supporting cast, you had an injury on top of it. And I want to shy away from any of these hitters dealing with kind of a long-term oblique injury in season. I just want to see how that plays out. Say Suzuki hasn't, you know, fully looked the same to me since he came back from his Casas. We'll have to see what he looks like. We'll see what Austin Riley looks like after what was, you know, a ridiculous absence on his part. But so, yeah, I'm a little worried about just any hitters with obliques right now. And Berger fits that description. So in some ways, I'm kind of just viewing it up, chalking it up to a lost season. And sometimes you got to be really cutthroat with decisions. And I think he's one where I'd be comfortable, you know, in a 10 or 12 team league, you know, releasing him to the wire and kind of wanting to see it before I buy back in myself.
That's totally fair. I've been getting rid of a lot of guys lately. I'm like maybe 50-50 on the success rate on dropping some of those guys. But yeah, I get it with the Jake Berger one. I can definitely see that as a potential move on situation, to say the least. All right. Someone I moved on from, and in the preseason, if you told me I would have moved on from this bat, you guys would have thought I was lying to you. But Bo Naylor, someone I was very excited about this preseason, not as excited as the William Contreras fan club that you and I are a part of. But Bo Naylor, I just love the skill set we saw last year. I was like, he's who we wanted Dalton Varsho to be. There's power, there's speed, like there's all these things. And then he just looks like a completely different hitter this year. It's like the dude striking out 36% compared to 23%. He's just the list goes on and on, is all I'm gonna say. Just it's ugly. So I've dropped him pretty much. I added David Fry instead of him. Like I'm moving on where I can find replacements. 15s are tougher. He's still hanging around. 12s I've moved on. What's your thoughts on Bo Naylor? Because I still think the skill set's good, but man, it's just a completely different dude.
I'm trying to, and if anyone, you know, is familiar with the exact story of this, you know, I might be misquoting it here, but there was something about when he was coming up that the Guardians, they care so much about their catcher defense. And there seemed to be a little bit hesitation with him entering the lineup. And I think this is when they had Austin Hedges. So it might've just been that Hedges was so preferred in that regard, but that just kind of made me, they weren't, what's the terminology? Like they weren't giving him the full runway of, okay, you're going to be, you know, our starting catcher from now on, the way it kind of felt like it should be. And, but anyways, he did, you know, he had a perfect split. I remember at one point sharing the stat over the off season of like his first X plate appearances were bad. And then the next X were really good. And when we see those like nice, easy, patterns, that really makes us want to believe this is just going to keep going up, or at least level off from what he showed again in the month of September, whatever it was. But yeah, I think that once the playing time, you know, really, you know, wasn't there either, that made it tough. And the Guardians are a team, I think, sometimes it's helpful also to just kind of think through the team's perspective, and they're clicking right now on all cylinders. So they don't really have a reason to mix this up. Obviously David Fry is deserving of as much playing time as he can handle right now as well.
Yep. I'm with you. And the Fry thing's fun, 'cause he barely even catches. Like him and Naylor were in the lineup together yesterday. Fry plays all over the place, first base, plays everywhere. So that's a fun one. But yeah, I think like you said, that they're clicking on all cylinders. So they probably like Hedges' defense back there than needing the offense type thing, unfortunately. I still think there's a lot to like with Naylor. Like, if you're in a dynasty format, I still think there's potential, like there's a lot to like there. But like you said, without the regular run for a young player, I hate getting yo-yoed, especially for kids. Like, they need to play. Mm-hmm. They need to go through the good. They need to go through the bad. They need to learn at the big league level. And that's just not happening right now. So that's a bummer. And that's a big miss for me on that one. One that's not a miss for me is I had zero shares of Corbin Carroll. I did not want Corbin Carroll. Some smart people did. They're very smart. They're usually better players than me too. But this is one that I got right, and I'm very proud of it. It's been a rough go. And the easy answer is he's still hurt. Like that's easy suggestion. People will say it's not, maybe not the answer, but that's what many will say, is he's still hurt. And it's leaning to look like that's very possible. Like that would make sense. 'Cause even after going 3-for-5 on Wednesday, Carroll's still hitting 194 with 2 home runs and 9 stolen bases on the season on 232 plate appearances. Like that's literally like a third of the way through the season. This is bad, Brendan. So what are your thoughts on Corbin Carroll? 'Cause like, he's so bad. If he was almost any other outfielder, you're dropping the dude,
mm-hmm.
but you can't drop Corbin Carroll. So how do you feel about this?
I'd be curious to see when it's all said and done, and you know, hopefully he does rebound. But if it stayed this bad, where that would rank among all time busts in the first round for a player who stayed healthy and didn't actually miss time. But in terms of just Cole McCarron, what's happened recently, and you know, the kind of valuation of him in fantasy and everything now, you're right, it is really bad. I'm in a daily league with him, which is a dynasty league. And every day I'm like, I don't want to start this guy. And that feels crazy because I'm starting platoon bats and I'm psyched to get Johnny DeLuca in there over him on those days that he plays. And so that's what's really stood out. It's, you know, Julio Rodriguez is struggling, but it's not this bad sort of thing. And the stuff about the injury, I've started to hear enough, you know, possible explanations from people about why he actually is, you know, just healthy, and maybe the shoulder isn't as strong as before, but it's not, you know, about to get operated on. And some of his stats last year, he got off to a really hot start, and but he was massively overperforming some of the expected metrics. And maybe that's when the shoulder was feeling really good and he had the ability to do that. And if the shoulder is just a little bit weaker right now, he doesn't, and it's going so far the other way that he's also getting unlucky. I've seen some stuff about the bat speed that would explain that he, you know, isn't feeling the effects of the shoulder injury. Someone, I think it was Jordan Rosenblum, compared it to bat speed data that was released by Baseball America last year. And, you know, what he's showing this year is not that far off from that. So it's a really juicy topic. And so I apologize for going on for an extra minute or to on him, but he's someone that I've been thinking through myself. And, you know, I'm sure everyone else just more than anything kind of wants an explanation. I think he's just running. I think it's a combination of that he was just kind of crazy overvalued, and he's also just running cold in terms of, you know, you're getting one of the lower ends of his range of outcomes.
Yeah, and that could definitely be the case. I've talked to a couple buddies that are Diamondback fans, Bogman and the Welsh, and like Bogman will shoot me straight. He won't be like Homer. Like Welsh should be Homer. I'll tell him that to his face. But Bogman, like he'll at least shoot you straight if it's going bad. And he thinks Corbin's just pressing. So he's in that camp like you're talking about, where maybe I'm just trying to like justify my thoughts of, no, he's hurt. See, I told you, like that's just, you know, what human beings do when you think you're right on something. Either way, like as a baseball fan, it sucks. Like I'd love to see him producing, very simple, because that dude's electric when he's hitting. Like in theory, like Wyatt Langford and him could be a lot alike when we think of the grand scheme of things, and it's all said and done. So hopefully it comes to be this season, like you're saying, or at least next season, like we didn't see like a little window and it's gone, which I don't think we did. I really don't. But yeah, it's a bummer to see. Like you said, it's tough to start him right now. So hopefully you can at least, you know, hold on to him and see how it goes. Like Dr. D in the chat said he went 3-for-5 today. I said, yeah, he went 3-for-5, still hitting .194 on the season. Like that's still not helping your fantasy team at all. It's just like, it's rough. It's a rough go for sure. A couple more here. And I wanted to hit on one that you added before we hit some of these other ones here, because it's a very fun one. This is a non-negative one. See, the first ones were, these ones are negative. Let's talk about a positive one here. And that is one Ben Brown of the Chicago Cubs, one of their top prospect pitchers. And the dude has been great. And I'll give him credit. I talk about yo-yoing hitters, Brennan. They've been yo-yoing Ben Brown between the bullpen and the starting rotation. And it hasn't fazed him. He just threw 7 shutout innings with 10 Ks against the Milwaukee Brewers in his last start. Overall, it's been great. I know you put out some tweets on him today, actually. So what are you seeing with Ben Brown? Because it's going to be hard to keep him, kick him back out of the rotation, it feels like.
Yeah, I think so. He was one of these guys who last year popped up as in Double A. He was a little bit older for the level, but he was kind of similar to Andrew Abbott. He was doing really well right away. But then it was, oh, it might be because the ball they were using in Double A was pre-tacked. All the strikeout rates were elevated. And it felt like for a little bit, though, that he was going to be in line with all these rookie pitchers last year to come up. And then it just never happened. And he was just got a lot worse in the second half. And the control ultimately became a big issue for him. And so myself heading into this year, just wasn't really thinking about him all that much. And then, you know, like you said, his role has been so back and forth. That's been, you know, really frustrating. It makes it tough to follow. It's really, I think pitchers are so more analyzed in the fantasy space because it's really clean. It's like, okay, they may start, then you have 5 days to kind of evaluate that against the body of work. And so anyways, just the role Ben Brown's in, it's been tough to get a read on what the Cubs think of him even. And I think that because of that, I've been surprised by the reaction to last night's start, because it feels like it's just being hand waved away a bit as, oh yeah, like, you know, this happened sort of thing. But that was the type of start where I took, you know, I watched it and he just looked incredible. And I think we've seen, again, we've talked about sometimes Tanner Houck, it just clicks for some of these young guys with good stuff, or Jared Jones or Garrett Crochet or Reagans or Scooble. And it can just happen so quickly, it seems like lately. And so I like Ben Brown a lot. That doesn't mean it's definitely going to happen for him, but when you look at his stats, including his time in relief so far this season, he's like top 20 in K minus walk in Sierra. I think he was 6th in FIP. And that does include the relief work, but that also includes he gave up 6 runs in his first appearance of the year out of the bullpen. And the stats are all still, you know, really, really strong. So, I'm pretty interested in Ben Brown. And the stuff about, is he going to join in the rotation or not? It's like, just think, if you're the Cubs right now, they're really scuffling, and it's more their offense that is their problem. But you just saw Ben Brown throw 7 no-hit innings against a team with a top 5 WRC plus in baseball, and you're going to put that back in the rotation for mop-up duty. I just don't think it works that way. I think Ben Brown's going to continue earning his spot in the rotation if he is as good as he looked last night.
I agree. And you're not the only one talking about him, because I saw some fun tweets, like, are talking positively about him, I should say, is Corbin Young, friend of the show, good writer out there, said Ben Brown has the highest swinging strike rate at 27% on a curveball in 2024 among pitchers throwing the pitch 200 or more times. It's been a nasty pitch against righties with a 128 wOBA and lefties with a 167 wOBA. So that curveball is great. Go if anybody's curious. There's a ton of really, really good stuff out there on Ben Brown. There's some good videos coming out there and whatnot. Lance Brozdowski had a video from like early in the season or even spring training where they were going over his pitches, and he retweeted that out today. That's some really cool stuff about the talents there. Like you said, it was kind of confusing. Is it the tacky ball? What is it? But he's showing it here, and they need to figure out a way to keep him in there to make it work for the long haul. All right, let's talk about a couple more guys here, and I want to talk Joe Adell, because about 2 or 3 weeks ago, it felt like it was happening with Joe Adell. And now over the last couple of weeks, it's happening again with Joe Adell, but the opposite direction. He's now hitting .216 on the air with his still has 10 homers and 8 stolen bases, still playing pretty much every day. What's your thoughts when you look at Joe Adell and on how things are going there in Anaheim?
I think something that really helps prop up Joe Adell is he's on the Angels, so they've been committed to him and they are just playing him. And they're also willing to run a lot because his success rate on steals isn't that high. But he's still just running, and that, so he's kind of this, a very useful, you know, five outfielder leagues, homer steal combination and roto. And the question then becomes the batting average, and he's hitting the ball so much harder. I know the drive line stuff gets mocked, often during the off season, especially, but I think it just hasn't gotten coverage, but he was one of these guys who went to drive line. I think he added bat speed, and that's just helped. He's, you know, at this point had so much time to get used to major league pitching that this was one thing that just, it's a lever that he could pull to get better. And, you know, I think he's pretty objectively gotten better. Does that mean he's going to ever reach the potential we thought he had as a prospect? Probably not. And I'm not even necessarily sure, you know, if he's going to be someone I want to invest in for fantasy entering next season. But right now he's got the runway. He's in the right situation. He's playing. And so, yeah, I would be riding this for as long as it lasts, for sure.
Yep. No, I'm with you on that one. It's pretty crazy that Kevin Pillar and Joe Adell are having these coming out parties in Anaheim. It's just the most bizarre team in the world right now. Last player I want to ask you about before I have one other question for you is Kyle Manzardo. This is one where I was not as aggressive on the waiver wire because I was just thinking like between playing time and I just wanted to see it kind of thing with Manzardo. Like the fall league was great, but it really wasn't all clicking. He had a hot streak there at AAA right before he got called. Still at .303 at AAA with 9 homers, like not denying that. But so far, .236, 30% K rate at the big league level. What's your thoughts on Manzardo? Because he feels like he could be the odd man out when Stephen Kwan comes back later this week, but we'll have to wait and see, I guess.
Yeah, the Cleveland's in the midst of facing a ton of lefties lately. That's part of why the David Fry story has been going on. He's getting opportunity, a lot of opportunity against lefties, but he's also then getting in there against righties. And Manzardo's not playing regularly against lefties. So that's one thing that, you know, before you can really, regardless of what you think of Manzardo as a talent, you know, you ideally want to see more playing time before you're fully trusting him, unless it's a situation where they have like a six-game week all against righties sort of thing. So I think first and foremost, Manzardo isn't a fully viable fantasy option yet, just because of that. And then you add on the whole, you know, kind of rookie struggling in their first go around in the majors. And Manzardo, because he's a little bit older, he has had a lot of AAA experience. His, you know, you read the scouting reports on him, they do say he's polished and it's a good hit tool. I think Travis Sawchuk on Twitter keeps, you know, tweeting out that he's hitterish, which that just sticks in my head as the way to describe him. He can, you know, he's not Freddie Freeman, but in the way that Freddie Freeman will just go get a fastball in the outer third of the plate and hit it down the left field line. And, you know, other guys are trying to hit a homer every time, but that's not exactly what Manzardo is going to be like. And so I do think he should have a quicker adjustment period to the majors. And so, yeah, so you kind of add that all together, and he isn't this priority, you know, breakout prospect, no matter what, that you need to have. But he's the type guy where if he, you know, for some reason is available in your league and he starts stringing together some positive performances, like I'll definitely be taking a look because of the pedigree coming into the year and what he's done in the upper minors.
Yeah, and I don't disagree with that. He's just a guy that I wanted to see it before because I had a tough time buying in, but I agree that the skills are there. But kind of going back to the beginning of all this, like maybe we should wait a year on some of these guys. And Manzardo, like I just didn't even know how the path to playing time was going to work for Kyle Manzardo. And that was my big concern with him. But eventually he'll get it going. The Guardians won't spend money, so Josh Naylor or someone will leave. And then the Manzardo will get to play because that's the way the world goes around in Cleveland. Last question I have for you, and you've mentioned it a couple times talking about players, and you're a solid data guy that can look at numbers a lot better than I can. So I'm just curious your thoughts on this initial bat data, bat speed, swing length, the guy that you've mentioned it a few times. What are your initial takeaways on this? Like, how are you trying to utilize it to kind of look at players? It's just so hard because we don't have any past data to compare it to, and we're trying to figure all these things out at once. So like, how are you utilizing it?
I am definitely of the mindset that I'm not as smart as the people who are going to eventually figure it out. So I'm going to let them focus on that. And from what I'm hearing from, you know, people whose work who would be able to, you know, kind of figure out what this all means. And I really respect their opinion on that. Therefore, what I'm hearing from them is they just need time. They need more sets of data. So it's something that I'm kind of not paying a ton of attention to right now. Other than I think it's really cool to be descriptive. Petriello had an article on Baseball Savant about Juan Soto and why Juan Soto is so good. It's because of this, you know, incredibly unique but dominant swing. And I really enjoyed reading that story. And I think that that's really cool that we're at a point in, you know, the stats and info that the public has where we know that and that we can explain why Juan Soto is so good at hitting baseballs. And but in terms of using it for fantasy, like I haven't tried to do that at all yet myself.
No, got it. No, that makes sense. It's kind of where I'm at. I'm like, I'm gonna let the smart people figure it out, and I'm gonna sit back and watch and kind of work, because like most data I use, I usually have something to kind of reference it to, and there's not a whole lot of reference points on this one, which makes it a little more difficult in my book to figure things out. All right, Brennan, we're gonna head on out of here. So before we leave, why don't you remind everybody where they can find you and what you got going on?
Yeah, for sure. I'm Brennan Tuma at Too Much Tuma on Twitter. My main job is for Underdog Fantasy and doing a lot over there, and then do some writing for Baseball America every couple of weeks. So can keep a lookout for those articles on every other Tuesday.
Yep. Awesome stuff as always. Brennan's a good follow on Twitter and it's a good guy in general. So follow his work, support him, and have all the fun stuff there. And my friend, thanks for joining me. We'll definitely do it again sometime.
Thanks, Bubba. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody, this is Bench with Bubba, episode 672. Catch y'all next time.